History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Josie Underwood was a well-educated, outspoken member of a politically prominent family in Bowling Green, Kentucky during the Civil War. She also left behind one of the few accounts of the Civil War written by a Southern woman sympathetic to the Union. Her diary begins several months before the first shots were fired on Fort Sumter in April 1861. "The Philistines are upon us," 20-year-old Josie writes in her diary, leaving no question about the alarm she feels when Confederate soldiers occupy her once peaceful town. Today I'm speaking to Nancy Deshier Baird, who published Josie's Civil War diary. It offers a firsthand account of a family that owned slaves and opposed Lincoln, yet remained loyal to the Union. Josie's father, Warner, played an important role in keeping Kentucky from seceding. Among the many highlights of the diary is Josie's record of meeting the president in wartime Washington, which served to soften her opinion of him. She describes her fear of secession and war and the anguish of having relatives and friends fighting on both sides, noting that in the spring of 1861, many friendships and families were breaking up, quote, faster than the Union. So in this episode, we talk about the life of Josie Underwood, and we also explore the fears and frustrations of living under occupation, which in this case was the strategically important Bowling Green, known as the Gibraltar of the Confederacy during the war. But despite the wartime upheaval, Josie's life is also refreshingly normal at times as she recounts travel, parties, local gossip, and the search for her true prince, as she wrote. So what this episode does is look at the experiences of normal citizens during the war and go beyond the typical military history explorations that people approach the Civil War with. We also see that a lot of times people paint a very clear dichotomy of the Civil War that it was either Northern abolitionist or a Southern slave owner. But between these two extremes, there were many, many shades of gray and people who didn't fit neatly into either one of those categories. And this is an example of one such person. So I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Nancy Baird about Josie Underwood and her Civil War diary. Nancy, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, I'm looking forward to talking about this because the more episodes I've done on the Civil War, the more I've started to notice that I think our approach is backwards, where we make the actual conflict itself more complicated than it really is, but we make the people who are involved in it, their views not very nuanced. I mean, sometimes people frame the Civil War as if there were only Northern abolitionists and Southern slaveholders, when obviously there's people all across the spectrum. So I'm looking forward to talking about Josie Underwood. How did you first discover her and her life?
Well, I discovered her diary in the Kentucky Library at Western. I guess I was looking around one day and came across it. And the first time I read it, I was fascinated. Here was a whole different way of looking at war. Most items about the Civil War and other wars are about the military aspects, the battles from a man's point of view, etc. This is a civilian that's caught in the middle of this war. And what happens to her life and to the life of other civilians? And first time I read it, I thought, this is what happened to the Fräuleins of Europe during the World Wars. And women in the Mideast today. Armies come in and take over and overrun and chop down and totally disrupt life.
Right. She gets a front row seat to all sorts of things. Her town is under military occupation. Her family themselves are very involved in the war, as we'll get into. But first of all, I'm curious about her early life and also the background of her family, because you note that they are slaveholders, yet fiercely loyal to the Union, which for those who've studied some of the Civil War isn't surprising, but for those who only have a passing understanding, that already challenges their assumptions. So please tell me about her and her family's background.
Well, both her father and her uncle were politically important in this state. Both had served in the Kentucky House. Her uncle had also served in the U.S. House of Representatives and was a county judge. Both of them were politically important and active. Her father and her uncle, who also lived in Bowling Green, were both slave owners, and both of them were opposed to slavery. but they'd inherited slaves and bought a few in order to keep families together. Now, the uncle was active in the ascending slaves back to Africa movement, the colonization movement. I don't think her father had ever sent any back, but they were both opposed to the institution. Both of them campaigned vigorously for John Bell of Tennessee in the 1860 presidential election. They feared that Lincoln would destroy the Union, etc. So Josie, apparently these things were frequently discussed at the dinner table, etc. And Josie was aware of them, and she talks about them in her diary, something a little different from most everything you read about the Civil War.
And can you also describe Kentucky and Bowling Green and it being a very contested site by the different camps before the war and the Union and the Confederacy during the war? Because this helps understand why she's caught up in so much action.
Yes. Well, Bowling Green was important during the Civil War because we are a doorway into and out of Confederate Tennessee. The L&N Railroad, for example, ran from Louisville on the Ohio River to Memphis, Tennessee, and went right through the middle of Bowling Green en route to Nashville, Tennessee. Bowling Green also was a good place for an army to be because the area around Bowling Green is relatively flat. But Bowling Green has a number of hills in it. And from the top of those hills, you can see for miles and miles anything coming towards the town. So we're a doorway into Confederate Tennessee, and we are easily taken care of and protected by the landscape, which makes for an interesting and, in this case, a dangerous position.
And I love these types of firsthand accounts, especially before major historical events happen, because even for me, who's studied history for a very long time, it's always a challenge to not get pulled into historicism and assume that people on the ground think that things will happen in the way that they did happen and they have some sort of foreknowledge of what's happening. But for them on the ground, of course, any number of things could happen, much as our lives are today. But it's a very simple thing to forget. So for Josie before the Civil War, what are her opinions and concerns and fears and assumptions about what's going to happen next before the war starts?
Well, apparently she had heard her father and uncle and other members of the family and community talk about if Kentucky secedes, what would happen, etc. She's very much concerned. She feels that Kentucky is in a dangerous position. We're a slave state, but we're also a Union state. And yet Kentucky was not a supporter of President Lincoln. Lincoln got very few votes in Kentucky in 1860. So we're a Union state, anti-Lincoln, and a slaveholding state, which is a weird combination for that period of time. And Josie apparently had listened to dinner table conversations of her father and others. I don't know if he campaigned vigorously for John Bell of Tennessee in 1860, and she may have gone with him on some of those campaigns. There's no record of that, but who knows? So she knew a lot more about politics of the period than most 20-year-old girls would have known.
Okay, so she seems to have a really good clear or a better than average insight of what's happening around her.
Yes.
And one of the aphorisms about the Civil War is brother against brother, which if you're in Massachusetts, that's probably not the case, or if you're in Alabama.
No, but in Kentucky it was. And she did.
Right. So this is interesting. So what's it like for her, this people joining different sides?
Well, she has relatives in both sides. She has friends and relatives on both sides. Offhand, I don't recall which is which. And she also has a young brother, 15 years old, and joins the Union Army. Crazy, crazy, a 15-year-old in the military. But she feels like half of her is in each side, with friends and relatives in both armies. And she is pro-Union, anti-Lincoln, and from a slave-owning family. And that is a strange combination.
Right. It's hard to find partisans or people who match up and have all those different criteria that she does. Would this this the animosity over the course of the Civil War, does it grow? Is there any type of restoration after it's over? I mean, just because to now the discussion in contemporary America is over political polarization and tribalism. So how does this play out over the years of the Civil War and afterwards?
Well, for Kentucky and especially for Josie's family and the Bowling Green area, they're very pro-Union to begin with at the beginning of the Civil War, although there are Confederate sympathies. The Confederates are here for 6 months, but the Union is here for 3.5 years. And by the end of the Civil War, Kentucky is far more pro-Confederate and anti-Union than it had been at the beginning of the war. And part of that is due to having had troops underfoot and destroying and taking advantage of the state for such a long period of time.
That's interesting because a lot of the rhetoric by the Confederate side is they're simply redoing what the Founding Fathers did 80 years ago. And I'm sure there's a lot of chatter about the Third Amendment and quartering troops, all that, and providing them provisions. What's Josie's personal take? And I suppose this can get into the Confederate occupation of Bowling Green.
Well, Josie is a Union, but by the end of the war, I think she's sympathetic with both sides and upset with both sides because of what happens here. Now, she and her parents will leave Bowling Green in the fall of 62. Her father is appointed as Lincoln's consul to Glasgow, Scotland. In essence, he's there to spy on shipbuilding, Confederate shipbuilding operations. And Josie goes to Scotland for a while. She doesn't like Scotland particularly, and eventually, about a year later, after she's been there a year, she comes back to Bowling Green and leaves her parents there and comes back to Bowling Green. But this diary does not include the days in Scotland and her return.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. Okay. One other thing too, in the book you mentioned what's happening with daily life. It's there are still parties, there are still social events.
Yes.
And I'm curious what this looks like for her, because a few years ago, a listener asked me to do an episode about daily life in the Civil War. And the experiences are very different for people. If you were in the wealthier parts of the industrialized North, you would have, you know, shoe drives and, you know, clothing collection for the troops. But it would be similar to, I don't know, the Iraq War 10 years ago, where you're supporting troops, but the daily life of someone really isn't that materially affected, versus parts of the South where your entire livelihood, whole communities and whole states are thrown into abject poverty. Their entire agricultural foundation is completely torn up. So experiences are very different from place to place. But how did life continue for Josie and her family during the Civil War?
Well, it's anything but calm. While the Confederates are here, they take over Josie's family farm. They camp on in the fields. They put their horses in the stable. They take the eggs out of the chicken house. They wander in and out of her family home like it was theirs. I mean, they literally physically take over. When the Union comes in, they do the same thing. The difference is the Union is here considerably longer. Now, when the Confederates left, they also burned the Underwood home to the ground and destroyed it. When the Union was here, they even took all the bricks that had been saved after the house was destroyed. So the Underwoods had nothing by the time the war was over. They had no home. Their fields had been destroyed. I guess their animals had either been taken away or died of hunger or whatever. Their workforce had been freed. Some of them were still around, but there was no home there. If your home's destroyed, you're just out of it. And that's what happened to the Underwoods.
What's it like for her going through this process where they lose everything? How is she coping with this?
Better than I would. They live with a family of friends in Bowling Green. And she doesn't talk a lot about day-to-day problems, but she does mention the fact that she misses had previously pre-war daily life. When her father returns from Scotland, he decides that Bowling Green, because his home has been destroyed, his office on the square has been destroyed, everything has been destroyed. He decides that Bowling Green is not a very good place to live. And they go to visit with family in California. And he considers moving his family and reestablishing a home in California. Now they don't. They come back to Bowling Green. But at least he thought about it and went out to see about it for a while.
Okay. We'll do the coda and see what happens to them after the war without jumping ahead too much. But tell me about her meeting with Lincoln in wartime Washington.
Well, Josie, in her diary, talks about Lincoln early in the war. She doesn't like him. She thinks he's probably a terrible person, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And she's surprised when she meets Lincoln, when she goes with her father. Lincoln will appoint her father as consul to Glasgow, Scotland. And Josie meets the president, and she says he's a much finer person than she expected. She really is surprised. So her feelings for the president are changed considerably. She finds him a very nice person.
Okay. So that's good to know that, you know, deeply held sympathies or antipathies towards someone can be changed. Were there any things when you first read it or upon rereading her diary that surprised you? Whether her observations, something that she mentioned that was going on, or characterizations of society that were counterintuitive? What sort of things like that jumped out to you?
Well, she's a little more outspoken than a woman would have been expected to be in that period of time. Now, she's reporting it, so whether she reports it as it really was or not, I'm not sure, but she's a little bit on the outspoken for a woman of that period, but she's very much interested in the politics. And again, she's recording in her diary. She's not expecting anybody to ever read it. So she's writing what she thinks, but it's kind of interesting that her ideas and her reactions to things that are going on. And she has friends and daily people that she meets daily from both sides of the fence. For example, she was in town one day and saw a young friend that she had known years earlier, and he's in a Union uniform. And he asks if he could come visit with her. And she looks up at him and she says, well, not in that uniform, you can't. So she's really caught in the middle of all this. And, you know, for a 20-year-old and for a female, she's rather outspoken, to say the least, and especially putting her sentiments, et cetera, on paper.
Hey, everyone. Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. You mentioned that she's communicating her fears and frustrations. What are her greatest fears throughout the war? Is it occupation? And some fears you could say come true, but are there any other things that she's concerned about?
Well, she's concerned about their home, about her friends. She has a 15-year-old brother who's wounded in battle, a 15-year-old on the battlefield. Gee whiz. She's concerned about what's happening to everybody and everything that's familiar to her, family, friends, and to a degree to the country, but especially to the area that she's familiar with.
You mentioned some about her family considering moving, but then coming back to Bowling Green. Mm-hmm. What happens to them after the war?
Well, her mother and father are both in bad health after the war. Her father died in the late 60s, and her mother sometime thereafter. Offhand, I don't remember the exact dates. But their home has been destroyed. They have virtually nothing at the end of the war. There's some papers in the library. It's not part of the diary that talks about how her father divides up what land he has left among his former slaves. And he'll give the former slaves so many acres of land and a cow or that kind of thing. But in essence, all they have at the end of the war, all the Underwoods have, is land for which they have no one to take care of it, no home, and they're really in bad shape. Her father dies a few years after the war. and her mother lives until the early 70s. Josie married in the 70s to a New Yorker, and they will live in New York in Bowling Green for a while, and then they move to New York, and eventually will move to California. And they're in California when her husband dies. And eventually she comes back to Bowling Green, and she's in Bowling Green during the first part of the 21st decade and a half of the 20th century. She died in 1923, I think, in Bowling Green.
That's interesting. How would you characterize her perspective of the war? Because I'm sure historians love finding people like this who aren't slotted in the typical figures that you think are powerful. Would you characterize her viewpoint as being upper class, as a woman, as a unionist, or how do you typically characterize her when you talk about her to other people?
Well, she's union, but not one that's really pushing hard. She wants the United States held together. And during the war, that is the family's whole feeling. But as I say, the war leaves them with virtually nothing. Land and no one to take care of the land, no home, no anything. Josie was also anti-Lincoln early in the war, but after meeting Lincoln, when she goes with her father to Washington, D.C., she finds Lincoln a far more kind person than she had previously thought of him. But how she feels by the end of the war, I don't know. There are virtually no papers by her about her at the end of the war. There's a diary that she kept in Scotland, but that diary ends at the end of the war.
What do you think are the biggest takeaways by reading about her experiences? You had mentioned that her views on Lincoln change, so entrenched tribalism that people feel can change, but she also lived at a time of intense division and polarization. So what do you think is the biggest takeaway from her story?
Well, I'm not sure. certainly, as I say, the diary ends when the family goes to Scotland. And she keeps the diary in Scotland, but it has nothing to do with the U.S., except she does talk about she heard this, that, and the other from the news, but she's not in the middle of it. And we have virtually nothing in the way of diary or letters that she wrote after the war, so it's hard to know. But she marries a New Yorker. She lives in New York. So I guess in some ways she feels great sympathy for Kentucky. But I really don't know exactly her political feelings at the end of the war.
Well, I always love hearing about these types of figures that exist in these gray areas that our minds typically don't think exist. And for a conflict like the Civil War, there are many stories like this. So I think it really helps to add a lot of nuance to that time period. So for listeners who want to dive in more, the name of the book is Josie Underwood's Civil War Diary. Nancy, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it.
That's all for today's episode. If you'd like to see show notes with sources, maps, links, anything else related to this episode, and all my other ones as well, go to ParthenonPodcast.com. That's the name of the podcast network this show is a part of, along with James Early's Key Battles of American History, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy, and other great history shows as well. If you'd like to support this show, the two easiest ways to do so are to subscribe to it on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. The second thing is to join the membership program for History Unplugged. If you do so, you'll get completely ad-free episodes for the entire back catalog, which is about 600 episodes and growing. And all you have to do is go to patreon.com/unplugged. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.